scattered bitter cold, and yet, half a world away, record heat still mounts. Thank you to at Kent Pittman at climatejustice.social for that haiku senryu. And yes, there was that odd, super cold period of New Zealand summer after the record heat spring summer, and we had some freezing cold. And now the extreme heat is well and truly back down here in the southern hemisphere. I am, of course, joined by Kent Pittman. Of course. Thank you very much for coming on the show live when you do, Kent. Do you want to say hi?
Sure, I'll say hi. Also, for me, for the context is funny this week because the temperatures have been running, well, I'll say them in Fahrenheit. You'll have to do the translation, but down at the single digits or zero or something like that for temperatures. So for us, that's well below freezing. And so much so that yesterday I was coming back from a trip and I stopped at a grocery store and I had been driving for so long that my winter jacket was in the back seat, and I pulled it on, and then I stepped out of the car and I said, and there was no wind or anything, but I was talking to somebody on the phone and I said, wow, it's like almost warm out here. I almost didn't need my winter jacket. And she said, like, how warm is it? And I went and looked, and it was 13 degrees, so still well below freezing. But it's just that it's been so far below that that seemed suddenly balmy. And yet at the same time, a good friend of mine that lives in Argentina had been complaining that she had been, and her family had been, in bed sick because it had been 104 degrees there with humidity, which is almost impossible to comprehend. So, yeah, extremes of temperature,
Northern Lights is just saying they got all the way to 20-something Fahrenheit over there. I've also had that experience, you know, if you're skiing or something. A temperature that's actually quite cold, the sort of T-shirt weather, that kind of thing happens. Let's just say hi to everyone in Lambed Moo, and then I'll go on my kind of... I have a sort of odyssey of recent news apropos deep learning that I'm going to tie into the climate, and we can get Kent's opinion on that. So if I at here, we're eating sushi in Paradise Sushi, Jay Lamutt's sushi place in Lambed Moo, which is the world's longest running, massively multiplayer, continuously online virtual reality, which I guess lives in Roger Cruz's garage somewhere. Idaj is there, and it was evidently 35 Fahrenheit today. I can only remember that when I'm cooking, I think that 400 Fahrenheit is 200 Celsius, and I'm pretty sure that zero or human body temperature, for example, is about 96 point something degrees Fahrenheit. This isn't really the me not knowing things about American temperature measurements show. So who was actually here? So at here. Net Settler being Kent Pittman, Screwtape being yours truly, now styled Screwlisp, mdhughes.tech, the game dev of the ages, Schroeder, our Schroeder is always at the show, not Alex Schroeder, also a good Schroeder. Northern Lights is here. Thank you for your show, Northern Lights. Northern Lights has a lot of great activist music against ice, which is not a very nice silver lining to need to have, but it's the music is quite nice. Northern Lights. Idaj is here, being Nosredna Idaj, whom I remember the Stanford student page of saying she writes her name backwards because she's a reverse engineer who transcribed, I think, Stanford's 7-track tapes, their labs. Foolsbane being Doug Merritt, whom I'll remember some deep learning stuff and neural network stuff he was saying on the show much later. Alex the Red is here. Vidak, who's in the southern hemisphere with me, and Ratsu is here. Thank you so much for being here, everyone. MDH says 400 Fahrenheit is a good pizza temp. That is, in fact, why I know. Yudge says 98.6 is the official human body temperature, but it's mostly wrong. Yeah, which part of your body, for example, or at what point?
Yeah, I wanted to inject a couple of things there too. I looked up
Yeah,
13
please.
degrees Fahrenheit, which was in my story, is minus 10 and a half degrees Celsius, just so that you know where I was talking. At 104 degrees Fahrenheit, which it had been in Buenos Aires, corresponds to 40 degrees Celsius. So there is that. It's also worth knowing that as you go back and forth, that there's a sense in which there's an implied error bar on these things, and sometimes when you change units, that can be very strange, because in Fahrenheit, the human body temperature is usually quoted as 98.6, as if somebody had done some super precise measurement, probably. And when you look at a number like that, you imagine they mean between 98.5 and 98.7, and that's a very tiny increment because Fahrenheit degrees are smaller than centigrade degrees. But in fact, that was originally measured in centigrade as 38 degrees centigrade. And that means plus or minus 1 degree centigrade, which is a much bigger range than plus or minus 0.1 degrees Fahrenheit. So you have to be really careful as you move things back and forth. This is the same
Thane
effect
was
as we
just
get.
saying, in Florida, people kind of make the opposite mistake. Well, just if the temperature is so high, a temperature that's still quite high can seem relatively cool as well if you're in 40 degree heat or something like that. Just one reason that one kind of control on how hot body temperature is obviously the way that biological enzymes work, or proteins work, sorry, such as enzymes. They work faster the hotter you get, so hotter is kind of better in that your biological processes that you need to do are going to work kind of complete their work faster. But they when you hit a high enough temperature, all the proteins bend into new shapes and you suddenly die, which is why human body temperature is quite a conserved, well, in certain parts of your body. So lots of your body can get colder, but if the parts of your body that are very active get colder, they're going to be working unreasonably slowly. But if they get 1 degree centigrade hotter, or I guess 4 degrees centigrade hotter, like you very quickly begin dying, something like that, which is why
Yeah.
fevers are such a problem. Sorry,
This is
I'm
a great
not really
metaphor.
a
This is a great
biologist.
metaphor for the climate, actually, because a lot of people look to the conversation on the climate where you talk about like, oh, the global average temperature is it going to be like, 2 degrees or something like that? And people think like, wow, like during the day the temperature varies like 10 degrees. That can't possibly matter very much. But the problem is that it isn't just for people in general, which you could think of as like part of the global body. But there are certain parts of the global body, such as growing crops, which are far more sensitive to temperature than we who can just put on a sweater or go into air conditioning, because the crops are just sitting out there not wearing sweaters and not going into air conditioning. And if you want them to continue to produce food for the planet, you have to care a lot more. So there's parts of the world that are considerably more fragile to temperature, and you shouldn't just use your intuition about what would feel comfortable moving around during the day. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
like there are cities in like in the Middle East that can reach 70 degrees centigrade, which is an unbelievable temperature. It's around there. If you get 2 degrees hotter, given how kind of movement upwards in temperature kills people. Well, in Mexico there was that heat wave, I guess last year, right, where people are at risk of death, or your friend, where if it's 40 degrees out, this is already quite critical. Your body has to work hard if outside is hotter than inside. Your
Well,
liver has to do the
it's very
bizarre
temperature
things before
dependent
your
because
body.
it has to do with whether the body can efficiently cool itself by sweating. And if it is moist outside, then the sweating action doesn't work. So it might be that in a very arid temperature, that you can actually have a higher temperature and still not feel as bad, because the sweating works, but only up to a point. So,
I
yeah.
said 70, and Edudge is telling me I probably meant 50, but
I
it's
think
some
50 is probably sounds
absolutely
better. That's true
unbelievable
also. Yeah.
Yeah, which we can't relate to. And then humidity and so I guess dry places you would be able to survive hotter temperatures by drinking more water and sweating a lot. Anyway, I wanted to get to my kind of arc, which was also going to connect to the climate through all of the like new curl vulnerabilities that were published, all the OpenSSL and curl vulnerabilities that were published recently, which I promise will actually connect to the climate. So just what happened for people who don't really follow cybersecurity news? Daniel, I think his name is, very active Mastodon user and the author of Curl. Curl is a library for downloading files or sending web or Gopher requests, this kind of thing. It's very useful. It's a kind of Swedish army knife, I guess. Hopefully I got the countries from right.
I think he means Swiss.
Swiss. Oh, but a Swiss army knife, but isn't Curl from Sweden? So hence the pun. I might have
Possibly. No, that
got
could be
that
right.
wrong. Yeah. So what had happened was he had a similar problem to Jack Daniel, who's also very active on the Mastodon, where they were early kind of targets for their projects, I guess, are kind of serious enough that they were getting absolutely bombarded by kind of speculative AI pull requests in their Git repository saying, "Well, look, I've improved your code like this. I've improved your code like this." Da 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 da. Retsu says, "The show, it looks like it's working to me, Retsu. I can see that it was choking a little bit. There'll be a PeerTube archive afterwards if anyone needs to catch up." What was I saying about this? Yeah. So the Curl author, who's active on the Mastodon, said he had to close bug bounties because he was being spammed with too many inauthentic bug finding things, and he doesn't have the kind of spare time to find out which of these LLM generated bug bounty turn-in requests actually had real vulnerabilities, because most of them didn't. And so Jack Daniel had been doing something similar. Incidental aside, Jack Daniel is looking for people to test his next version of embeddable Common Lisp, just before I forget that. Anyway, after closing those bug bounties, a medium-sized, I guess, cybersecurity company with lots of university connections, but they're a private company, published, I think, 10 new significant vulnerabilities in OpenSSL, and I forget the exact number, but about 10 in Curl as well, after Curl closed their bug bounties because of the kind of LLM AI spam they were getting. And the company said they were using LLMs as part of their workflow. I looked a little bit into this. So cybersecurity companies don't publish very much of what they do, but I did find a web page where one of these companies did describe how they do this. And what they said was they use deep learning to find Git commits similar to known vulnerabilities or previously published vulnerability Git commits. So they're kind of matching all commits and new commits against commits that were kind of previously uncovered to be vulnerabilities, which they did, and they did say they were using deep learning to do that. But then I found elsewhere on their website they say there is some kind of verbal reasoning or company use of LLMs as well. But it seemed like that at least that company's kind of historic and current efforts were deep learning, so finding using deep learning to match commits against previously known vulnerable commits. And then what was I going to say about this? How did this connect to the climate? And so I was going to say this strategy seems like it would work for like regulations about the climate. We could find kind of previous successes of the climate, and we could also find like previous vulnerabilities, which I guess were regulatory exploits that were closed. And we could use something like a deep learning approach to find regulation that looks a lot like regulation that had needed to be fixed. Kent, did you have any particular thoughts on this? Sorry, I kind of went in a more rambly direction here.
Well, we talked about this before the show, and I was saying that I was thinking that I would have something to say. The new thing that has occurred to me in between is it's sort of like there's a joke that says, "How do you know when a politician is lying?" And the answer is his mouth is moving. And the thing is that with regulatory anything anymore, pretty much all of that stuff is being offered from big business, and big business is mostly just trying to do exploits, it feels like these days, such that it's a pretty easy mark to look at regulation and just assume it's trying to create an exploit. It's just like, oh, here's one packaging, here's another, just look at the series of commits. But I do think that the strategy that you're talking about, if the system were healthy, would be a way of possibly identifying things. You know, if you thought people are acting in good faith, it's just that it's almost like too easy fishing right now to just assume that everybody's out there doing that. So,
I just wonder, like you said, if everybody's doing that, you can imagine kind of the bad actors who are basically profiting by using unregulated kind of climate destruction, so sort of destruction of the commons, the earth, to profit. And then the idea is that I guess countries would somehow have to try and clean up their mess afterwards. And like you said, something that's been very common in this world. Like, so the bad actors probably have IT departments searching for ways to get bad legislation through, or weak politicians or something like that.
I mean, I think mostly it's that their goal is actually to make money. And so the real question is, like, usually they're just perturbing some aspect of other regulation. And the question is, why is each individual piece of stuff really just an attempt to make money? And that's kind of a sad way to look at it, because I would like to think that people are altruistically trying to just make a better society. It just lately does not much feel that way,
Yeah,
because it's
you're
really
right.
hard.
So I'm kind of maybe being too rosy, but well, it would be interesting to kind of turn deep learning on that in a similar way to so I guess in this case the author of Curl, for example, is kind of a genuinely good actor, I think, in the Mastodon and in the making secure TCP connections
I
kind
mean,
of
I think
space.
open source sort of represents, I mean, it's sort of like old style democracy, if you can remember a day when maybe people were making laws for the public good or something like that. Like, it's not like nobody ever did anything bad or anything, but it was like just a statistical matter. I mean, I think that your analogy is a really good one, even though I think that the spaces are just in different states of disrepair.
So I was this was kind of this topic was also kind of apropos. Oh, we've been joined by Jay Lamott. His name I believe is John, but I might have got that wrong. John Lamott, who created Paradise Sushi, where we're also enjoying sushi while we talk. And then, so the deep learning connection, I guess recently I wrote a symbolic deep learning implementation in Common Lisp, which I guess you can read your writing about, and thank you to everyone who was participating in that as well so far. But I made a more, I used kind of the low-level implementation bits to make one example, at least, more usable deep learning program, deep learning inferencing program, I guess. And I really based this on Common Lisp condition handling. And so I hope that we're going to be able to get into the kind of condition handling topic here. As you know, one of my kind of New Year's resolutions was to really start properly embracing and at least being aware of some of the implications of Common Lisp's conditions. And Kent had a few great notes. Actually wrote maybe three different vignettes on the Mastodon in response to some of my articles. Did you have anything you wanted to say about Common Lisp conditions that was sort of at the front of your brain here, Kent?
Well, I think the three things, and you should ask or highlight things that you found interesting or ask questions about what I wrote, but I mean, a lot of it was about the interaction between Lisp as a highly dynamic language and how that manifests in terms of program changes, which you're talking about there, like commits and so on. Like what kinds of changes is it preparing you for, and how that affects abstraction. And I also, as I mentioned to you before the show, the that interacts with semantic versioning, which also goes with the thing, the thread you were following for that other thing. So yeah, I have some things to insert there, and we can go in whatever order you
Well,
like
I can
that.
very briefly explain kind of my side of the of provoking those vignettes that you wrote. Kent obviously like the Common Lisp condition system as ended up in ANSI Common Lisp, our programming language. Kent was a major author of that, though it got changed quite a lot through the standards committee from your was it revision 80.txt document originally?
Just
So you
18,
contributed a
yeah.
lot to that one. Oh, eight, yeah.
I'm
I
just
got one
imagining
of the
in my mind
digits
80 iterations that were as
right.
tested as that.
Okay, what was I about to say about this? So I didn't really have a lot of condition handling in my code, and Kent has talked previously about how the condition system, as it was sort of realized in ANSI Common Lisp, is another example of kind of Lisp thought leadership, because Lisp is kind of the bordering on two avant-garde kind of scientific and software engineering language in many respects. Like it had multiple inheritance very early, this kind of stuff. And so I was just getting into using that, and I was writing these articles, just kind of showing people sort of hello world style programs in Common Lisp using conditions, quite similar to examples that Kent had written in the Common Lisp hyperspec, which is kind of Lisp's online documentation thing. And something Kent kept pointing out to me and wrote at length kind of explaining is that it's wrong and misleading to use Common Lisp's condition system. Maybe I should ask you to try and explain, Kent, in ways that look like I'm just using lexically scoped throw and catch. Are you able to summarize that
I mean, and
that
also, like,
difference?
it's not just really. I did say lexical, just exactly as you say. So this is not me correcting you, but just sort of correcting maybe myself from another day. It's not just lexical. It's, let's say, lexically apparent ways of expressing things, because the dynamic operations of catch and throw are sometimes the things you want also. Like, the only place where you really want the condition system is where you're not writing both halves of the program. That's why I keep saying it's about a protocol, because if you're just writing a thing which goes into a deeply nested function call and then suddenly wants to return out, in Python you have really no other mechanism than to do an exception kind of thing if you just want to return many levels up or something like that. But Lisp has catch and throw specifically so that you can get out of something, and it isn't a lexical matter generally. You could do it as a lexical matter if you nest some functions and you create the function in a context where it can actually see the tag, but that's not the way people always write their programs. And so Lisp gives a lot of flexibility to how you lay out your program in terms of whether you want to specify that inclusion thing dynamically or lexically, but that's different than the question of whether you want to discover it. And the common Lisp condition system is really about the idea that I don't know whether it's there. And if you don't know whether it's there and it's on the previous page of your code, then go read your code and use a different mechanism. But if you don't know it's whether it's there because you don't know who's calling your code, then you don't know whose code to go and read. And that's where reflection turns out to be useful. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, thank you very much for that explanation. I see that we have actually been joined by Ramin Honery. How are you, Ramin?
Hello. Yeah, I'm doing well. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Do you have any thoughts on reflection and exceptions or conditions? Again, this week, it's one of my annual themes.
Right. Well, unfortunately, I don't have a lot of expertise in this area. Mm-hmm. My own implementation of Emacs Lisp is just a lot like Python. You know, I just gather the whole stack up and give it to him.
So if we can get all the Python people using Kent's implementation of ANSI Common Lisp style condition handling for Python, and then you use Python-like error handling in your Emacs Lisp implementation, we might be able to sneak it in that direction. What else have you been up to this week, Remy?
Well, yeah, before I get into what else I've been, I just wanted to say I really should learn more about Common Lisp and this condition system, because I'm sure it could be implemented pretty straightforward way in Scheme. And if that's the case, it may indeed be pretty useful for people who are trying to write their scripts, their text editing scripts or whatever in Scheme. So it would be nice just to have, to bring in as many systems as I can from Common Lisp, if it makes sense, to bring them into Scheme. But this is just a matter of time, which unfortunately, and getting into your next question, yes, didn't have a lot of time this past week. I've actually been extremely busy trying to find a new job, and just haven't had time for anything else other than doing interviews and so on. So I am hopefully going to finish my GUI, reactive kind of framework pretty soon. I realized that I made the mistake of keeping parts of the GUI state in variables, and that can lead to things being kept too long, and that can also lead to things being duplicated.
Cache invalidations.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to do that. So I've come up with a way of the way CSS works in in HTML, of selecting nodes that are already in so that you can send signals to them. That way you don't have to do a complete update of the whole tree every time. So if you want to just signal something that's drawing an image or something that's putting a character into a text buffer, you don't have to re-render everything just for that. So I've created a CSS-like system just this past week. Yeah.
Good. Kent, did you have anything to add or kind of say to her in the context of Ramin? Otherwise, I have a great pun about conditions and something Ramin just said.
I don't have anything specific. You should just go ahead with that.
All right. So Ramin was just saying he would like to add, dynamically add features to Scheme packages that, if you just knew ahead of time that you wanted those features, of course you would program them in. And for everybody who's really familiar with ANSI Common Lisp's conditions, what Kent calls half programs. So you have local restarts in Common Lisp, and this lets you write handlers outside of your program, which you kind of put into the environment that you're running your program in using handler bind outside of the program that you're running. to add new handlers, and these handlers can accept conditions that have been signaled inside your program, and your handler can then locally restart inside your program after they've handled something. And so when Ramin is talking about the problem of wanting to add features that you didn't know you would want previously, if you add ANSI Common Lisp's condition system, this is actually one of the things it offers. Did my pun kind of make sense, Kent?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think your audio got garbled there for a second. But
because one thing about errors, for example, is that you haven't really planned for an exceptional situation to happen. That's why it's an exceptional situation, or Lisp generalizes this to conditions rather than just errors, I guess. So of course you can't plan for situations you thought